There are many of us in the community who are very worried about the selling of the farm and the privatisation of just about everything. But amazingly, when you think about it, it's not only the selling of the farm or selling of an electricity company or a water supply. There's the selling up of places like jails as well. It doesn't only happen here in Australia, it happens in America and pretty much all over the world it's happening. Anthony Lowenstein has written a book called The Prophets of Doom. Anthony's a freelance journalist with a number of organisations, including The Guardian, and he's written this book, Prophets of Doom, and joins us now. G'day, Anthony.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very, very welcome. Anthony, it's an interesting book about this privatisation of such things as jails, and you've written quite a lot of pages about such things.
Yeah. One of the things I think that a lot of people are not aware of is that increasingly this is a bipartisan issue. Doesn't matter who's in power in Canberra, Labor, Liberal, Coalition, it's irrelevant. Doesn't matter who's in power in Victoria, Labor, Liberal. This is an issue which goes back about 30 years where there's an ideology, I think, and a belief that it's somehow more efficient and cheaper, so the argument goes, if you outsource to a private corporation. The problem is when you talk about prisons or detention centres for asylum seekers, the records actually of these centres and of these providers is often pretty bad. And I say bad as in bad for the detainees and also bad for the staff. Bad meaning not particularly good conditions, often not very unionised. Human rights abuses happening for both sides. And I spent a lot of time in this context going to the detention centres for refugees, often in the middle of nowhere, Curtin in WA, Christmas Island, obviously, which is 3 hours from Perth. And what you find in these places is a very strange environment where the company Serco, which is a British multinational, which is one of the biggest public service providers in the world, which has a terrible record in the UK, government after government puts out report after report saying how appalling their services are, despite that they get more and more contracts. And when the Labor, former Labor federal government, signed a contract with Serco in 2009 for detention centres, it was $370 million. The boats, of course, have surged in the last 4 years, as listeners will know. And the contract is now worth over $1.86 billion. Now, there's nothing illegal about that. It's legal. But the problem is, and I have whistleblowers and other documents from inside Serco, which shows that as more people were going into detention, there was less training to the staff. So you often have individuals, guards, who are working in these places in the middle of nowhere, who are going there because they want to earn money, reasonably enough. And they're often suffering mental trauma themselves, putting aside the asylum seekers as well.
You can sort of understand, you know, going into a job like that, it'd never be an easy task to be taking on such a job, you know, to look after people who are coming in droves from overseas, yeah, who are traumatised before Indeed. They arrive properly, and then working out how to deal with their trauma.
That's true. And one of the problems, I think, is, and again, the documents I have from Serco inside show that, and in fact, this individual who's still a senior manager at Serco is telling me that the culture within the organisation, that documents show that as more and more people were coming, more asylum seekers were coming from Iran, Afghanistan, etc., in the last few years, Sri Lanka, there was actually the staff themselves were not being increased. So you had a situation where, yes, individual X goes from Perth or Melbourne or Sydney and wants to earn some money in a detention centre. That's fine. It's totally legal. However, there are countless cases which don't get a lot of press of these individuals who are going there who are suffering trauma themselves because they're seeing, often on a daily basis, children self-harming, adults trying to commit suicide in centres which are inherently remote. I mean, Curtin, for those who don't know, is in the middle of the Kimberley Desert, 2 hours from Broome. I was there in the middle of summer. It's pretty damn hot. You have 1,000 men, roughly, asylum seekers who were there, mostly all men. There are a few female guards, but predominantly men. And you can imagine that's a pretty stressful environment. And one of the things I've talked about in the book and in other workers, mine in The Guardian particularly, is to say that do we as a society feel comfortable with a situation where these things are happening almost out of sight, out of mind? And the governments, of course, are happy about that. They're remote. The media often doesn't go there. It's very difficult as journalists to get access to these places, which I think is problematic for openness and transparency. And ultimately, I think as a society, we have a choice. Do we want to outsource everything to a private corporation, which in this case is foreign, whose record is pretty bloody awful?
That's right. How easy or hard was it for you to get access to a place like Curtin?
You can get in there. Essentially, the government, the immigration department says anyone can go in there if they want. The Serco says the same thing. The problem is, and this is, I guess, the arrangement that's almost the system has been gamed in a way, that both sides blame the other. So if you want to get access, you go to the immigration department and they say, speak to Serco, and then vice versa.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The way it works is you're supposed to give a name of an individual, an asylum seeker inside, who can then give you permission to come in. That's the theory. But the problem is that the immigration department and Serco, and there are other organisations that are also involved in this process here and also in Manus Island and Papua New Guinea and Nauru, where the new Abbott government's likely to send more asylum seekers in the coming months and year. There's not a lot of openness, put it that way. It's not a gulag. I'm not saying it's not a concentration camp, but these centres are deliberately attempting to make life difficult. And some would argue that's a good thing as a deterrent, but it's not working. And ultimately, I think as Australians, and this is my own personal view, we actually are causing more damage than anything else. Not just to asylum seekers, who obviously this is a very complicated and toxic issue, as any listener will know, in Australia in the last 15 years, but also the individuals who are Australian citizens who are working in these places. Many of them who constantly write to me. I don't know these people personally. I write about this stuff in the media, and they constantly contact me saying, we are not being heard, we are being assaulted, we are being treated badly by the corporation, or for that matter, the government. We can't get accountability for what's happening to us. And you have millions and millions of dollars that are being paid out, often a taxpayer's money, I might add, which doesn't get much press, because they had mental trauma themselves. And this, to me, is a system which is actually worse than not getting better.
It's not only in Australia this is happening. Of course, you know, you've also looked at America and what happens there. And it's not a very pretty picture there, is it?
It's not. And for those who don't know, America has the highest rates of incarceration in the world, predominantly African-American, predominantly because of the so-called war on drugs. So I read a case again this week. Crazy situation. Often states have a three strikes and you're out rule, so to speak. 20-year-old guy had two minor drug infractions. Third one, he had a few grams of marijuana. Now, some listeners might think that deserves a life imprisonment, but I would argue that's pretty insane. He gets 25 years, and that's just the law. And the problem is that in many of these states in the US, there has been a collusion between private prisons and the state, where lobbyists, and again, this is mostly legal, which is part of the problem, lobbyists from private prison corporations are making sure legislation is drafted in these states that if prison beds are not filled to a certain extent, they get paid money from the state. It's an insane arrangement. And that sort of thing is not happening quite as blatantly here, but there's talk about it happening. There are more and more prisons being outsourced. In the US, ironically, in the last few years, it's Republican states, the more conservative states, that are saying the war on drugs is not working. A blind person can see that you have millions of people locked up, mostly black, people not smoking less marijuana or taking less ice or whatever. It's not happening here as well, for that matter. Isn't there a way to not outsource all our prisons to private corporations who are making a fortune and not actually providing the best care because they have no incentive to do so? The bottom line is all that matters. And so I'm not going to say there's been a massive turning of the corner in the US, but there's some movement of change, hopefully.
Is there any particular part of the USA which is worse than the other? Louisiana comes to mind, which
Indeed.
Is a shocker.
There are certain states which are particularly in the Deep South, which have obviously historical issues in terms of white-black relations, where when you have the predominant population, I mean, the majority of Americans are not black, but the majority of populations in prison are African-American. And that's not accidental. There's a book a few years ago called The New Jim Crow, which was put out by an American writer, which essentially talks about how the incarceration of African-American, particularly men, but also women too, but particularly men, is almost a new form of slavery, where you have generation upon generation of people who are being thrown into prison. And the majority of crimes are not what I would call serious. We're not talking about murder. Obviously, people do kill people, and that needs to be managed. But this is predominantly minor, non-violent drug crime or non-violent crime. And when private prison corporations are able to get in on that and make a massive profit, I think a lot of people in society, on the left and the right, I might add, are uncomfortable about that. And they have an incentive in some ways through lobbying to actually make sure that the people remain in jail.
It's amazing, isn't it? What about in Australia? Is there a particular, any state in Australia which is worse than another?
Well, Western Australia.
Or is it about?
Western Australia has got a higher incarceration rate per capita of black men than during apartheid South Africa. This is predominantly for minor crimes, drug infractions, alcohol abuse, etc.
Car theft and things.
Car theft. I would say non-violent crime, not to justify car theft or those sort of things. But we have a weird situation where in WA, this is happening. And in the East over here, we don't often hear much about WA. But I think it's a problem. And there are definitely private prison corporations that are making a lot of money. Thank you very much from that arrangement. And again, the issue is not to say anyone who works for a private prison or detention centre is a bad or evil person. I've met a lot of people who were actually quite ugly and racist, which is not fine at all, and I think I condemn that in the book and what I'm saying now. But this arrangement actually benefits the minority to the exclusion of the many, and I think in WA, unfortunately, the model of the Barnett government, who's the WA Premier, there's an attempt to try to copy that, I think, in states over here in the East.
Andrew Lowenstein's written a book called The Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. When it comes to vulture capitalism, it's not only about prisons. It's also about going to war. And it comes to mind that when we went to war with America back in 2003 to invade Iraq, we took Halliburton with us.
We did. For those who don't know, Halliburton is an American multinational. In fact, it started before then. Really, Halliburton's been around for a while. 9/11 happens. And in fact, weirdly enough, on September the 10th, the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld, who was then the defense secretary, gave a speech saying that the main enemy was bloated defense spending. We had to cut everything and therefore outsource more. 9/11 happens. We went to war in Afghanistan by October 2001. As you said, Iraq started in March 2003. And war has been outsourced forever. This is not particularly new. What is new, though, is the extent of it in the companies like Halliburton, Blackwater, whose records actually are incredibly poor. Their ability of accountability is incredibly weak. And the result has been in both Iraq and Afghanistan. I spent time in Afghanistan last year looking at these kind of contracts and the reality of private contractors who are working. For many of those who don't know, in Afghanistan today, there are more contractors than there are soldiers. Now, they're not all mercenaries. Some of them are making meals for Australian troops. But the problem is that often you have amazing amounts of abuse. And to the extent where, for example, last week, the US Congress put out a report that pretty much dropped without a, like a stone. The US has spent roughly $90 billion on aid in Afghanistan since 9/11. And it's often to private corporations that are delivering that aid. And it's still said up to today, there is no effective method of assessing how that money is being spent. Now, this to me is a problem. This is a real problem. And Australia with AusAid, we have a similar issue where obviously we're not as involved because we're a smaller country. Our budgets are going to be smaller. But there's no doubt that the militarization of aid with certain corporations in the in Afghanistan, Iraq, that we as Australian taxpayers are paying, the results simply are not there on the ground. So when the Australian government, whether they're Labor or Liberal, this is a bipartisan problem. When they both sort of say we're there to help the Afghan people or the Iraqi people, too often, having spent time there, I can tell listeners that that's not particularly long-lasting. When we pull out, which we're going to be doing by the end of this year, majority of troops will probably keep some special forces there indefinitely. Our legacy is pretty bad, and the amount of money that Australian taxpayers have paid often to private corporations to deliver that aid is left wanting. I think that sort of thing is people should be aware that war should not be privatised to corporations with a pretty bad record.
It hasn't been a good result, has it?
It has not. It has not.
When it comes to privatisation, there is no nation in the world that privatises more probably than the USA. And I guess it'd be fair to say that when Barack Obama became the president of the USA, everyone went, there is some hope after George W. Bush. How do you think he'll be judged?
Well, in terms of foreign affairs, pretty badly, I would say. I mean, certainly in short, anyone who spends time in the Middle East, and I do often, there is profound, not just disquiet towards Obama, but I think contempt by a great deal of the Muslim world. And that's not because there was hope. As you said, he came into power. He spoke a different language. His rhetoric was lovely. It was friendlier, was more inclusive. But the reality on the ground is that in many countries, Israel-Palestine, that conflict is no real, despite what often we hear in the press about peace talks, the occupation of Palestine continues, it's worsening, it's deepening. Obama also has continued a global, it's almost like, there's a book by Jeremy Scahill, who's an American journalist, called Dirty Wars, which was a New York Times bestseller a few months ago. He talked about how Obama has deepened and worsen this sort of covert assassination squads that Bush put into place. That sounds like a conspiracy theory. It's not. It's basically CIA and private security firms going around the world killing people who we are apparently being told are terrorists. There's something called the Kill Tuesday list, which sounds Orwellian, where on Tuesdays Obama and his key people look down a list of people, this was reported in the New York Times a few months ago, who should live and who should die by drones. And the problem is often that intelligence is wrong. Often civilians, many civilians in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia are being killed. And the effect of that, of course, is hatred of America, hatred of the West. So the legacy, look, there are, I'm not saying everything has been bad. There's been some positive things domestically in the US. But certainly overseas, the record of Obama and in terms of the privatization agenda, he talks before he came into power about the disaster the Bush years of outsourcing wars. Well, here we are in 2013. He's got 3 years on the clock left and nothing has changed.
Yeah.
And it's actually getting worse. So I would say he gives nice speeches, but the reality is a little bit different.
And I suppose it'll continue to happen. And it's been great talking to you. The book is called Prophets of Doom, published by Melbourne University Publishing. Enter your nearest bookstore now. And you can read Anti Lowenstein's column 2 in theguardian.com. Been great talking to you.
Thanks for having me on.